This is a joint work with Roger Pawlowski, Ed Wilkes, Louis Romero that work with me on the stability analysis project, Rich LeHook, who does the eigenvalue part with me, and John Shadid, who hired me and leads the fluid mechanics project that I'll be talking about a lot as well. By stability analysis, it's just a shorthand way of saying both eigenvalue calculations and bifurcation, tracking continuation methods. So instead of giving an introduction, I'll give you my elevator talk. Elevator talk is what you give when you get in the elevator and somebody really important steps in, hits a button, says, "So what are you working on these days?" And an elevator, and I translate it into English for other colleagues, a lift talk. But and so an elevator talk isn't allowed to have any graphics, and it should be memorized in case you're nervous around the people who get in the elevator with you. So we're developing a library of stability analysis algorithms that work with massively parallel computer codes, engineering analysis codes. The main research issue is developing algorithms to be as non-invasive as possible, so you can have more people that you can hook your algorithms up to, or more codes anyway, and that that work well with iterative linear solvers, or reasonably well anyway. And this software, which we're calling LOCA, we've been able to track bifurcations of million unknown PDE discretizations. So when I gave this talk, part of this talk at a chemical engineering meeting, there was two main differences. One was I was wearing a suit, and the other one is that I had needed a slide saying, why do we need a stability analysis capability? And for this audience, we don't need to do this. But there's a multiple steady states, ignition, all these things. And the way I sell it at Sandia and other places is in terms of a tool to help doing computational design and optimization. Optimization seems to have really good support. So if I can say you need to know where the bifurcations are before you can optimize, that sells it some well. So the capability that we're delivering is, in the project is expertise, but also this LOCA library, which I'll be talking about a lot today. So we're targeting large-scale application codes, and this severely restricts the choice of algorithms you can implement. So to give you an idea of the targeted codes, right now we're only looking at Newton's method codes. I think the algorithms we have would work with matrix-free Newton methods as well, but we haven't tried that, but it shouldn't be any different. Large-scale parallel applications. The main code that we've been working on is a Navier-Stokes code that also does heat transfer and any number of chemical reactions, reaction diffusion, multi-component transfer, port the whole bit. A free surface flow code, molecular theory code, and in the future we're looking at some buckling of structural mechanics applications, and we have a circuit simulation code that they could use at least some homotopy, if not some more interesting methods. So the requirements as I see them is that the stability analysis algorithms that we develop must be scalable and relatively non-invasive. Scalable means going to large number of processors, large problem sizes. And the main thing, when I define large, is where maybe the easiest way to define large is where you can only use iterative linear solvers. That's maybe the best definition of large. Things that we should try to avoid or limit when we develop these algorithms is requiring more derivatives of the user, of the application code. These codes are already huge, 100,000, 200,000 line codes with, if they've done analytic derivatives for the Jacobian, it was a huge undertaking. You're not going to ask them to go through and take derivatives with respect to all their parameters, second derivatives, anything like that is just totally out of the question. One thing you want to avoid is changing the sparsity pattern of the matrix. There's a lot of work getting into setting up a parallel matrix solver, and this causes a lot of problems. And significant increases in memory requirements is also something you can't do. So we've developed LOCA, the Library of Continuation Algorithms, a nice little southwesty sounding name to fit in there. One set of the algorithms that we've developed include arc length continuation, turning point or fold tracking, pitchfork bifurcation tracking, phase transition tracking for our molecular theory application, and we can actually hook up to an optimization code. And the way we've done this is to try to do minimally invasive and easy to implement with the codes. We can do all these algorithms by just asking for a few simple things from the application code. And if this code already has Newton's method, it can do these things very easily. Asking for a right-hand side, or residual vector, or your F vector, to invert a matrix times a vector, the Jacobian matrix, inverse of that times some matrix, or approximately, to do a MATVEC multiply, and to vary some parameters. So by just asking the code to do a few things, the interface just includes mostly these calls. Fill in these calls with the calls to do that in your code, and you can do all these algorithms. Furthermore, if you want to do eigensolvers, we've hooked up with the ARPAC library and worked on drivers for the Cayley transformation, and helps that my colleague is Rich LeHook, who wrote ARPAC with Danny Sorensen for his thesis. To do that, you just have to be able to ask the code to fill a mass matrix, which is the coefficient of time-dependent terms. And to be able to solve a shifted matrix, J plus sigma M, where sigma is some real parameter that we give it. And then finally, we've added a Hopf tracking algorithm. And this is more difficult. It requires the ability to solve in a complex matrix, J plus I omega M, which usually would make a double-sized real system. But this kind of violates some of our goals at the beginning about not changing the sparsity pattern, not increasing memory usage. But it turns out one of our linear solver guys liked the idea of doing this and was going to do it anyway. And so with our linear solver, this is that we use, it's easy. But I've tried to do all these algorithms. It doesn't see the algorithms don't see the matrix, don't care what format it's in, don't care what linear solver you use. We just say solve your matrix, and it returns. We give you B, you give us J inverse B, however you do your J, however you do it. And so we try, in general, the matrix format and don't appear anywhere in our code, only in the, what I would consider the interface, the other code. So that's kind of the software engineering part, which is maybe a third of my job, and algorithms and applications are the other thirds. So here's a quick summary of the algorithms or the bifurcation that we do. Simple parameter continuation, some residual vector as a function of x, the unknowns, and p, some parameters equals 0. And p is just this. And so we can do zero order, first order. Add one extra equation, you can do a pseudo arc length continuation. If you solve 2n plus 1 equations on unknowns, you can formulate a turning point or fold tracking algorithm. The steady state, the Jacobian triumph sum null vector is 0, and that vector has length 1, where L is some vector that you can give. Phase transitions in thermodynamics in this molecular theory code we have aren't actually a bifurcation, but they're the most important point, what they look through. So you have two solutions, x1 and x2, that are at the same parameter, are both solutions to the equations and have equal energy. So it's vapor, x1 is a vapor phase and x2 is a liquid phase. You plug them into your equation of state, they both satisfy it at a parameter and have equal energy. And so it's very similar to the other things. And we have a pitchfork tracking algorithm and a Hopf tracking algorithm. And you know, it's the same idea as a turning point. You just kind of write out the definitions and solve them. Well, I talked about the solving. So these are how we determine or define our bifurcations. And so this is kind of, the math here shows how we solve it. And so the research question that we've been working on a lot is, can these very general bifurcation algorithms that just go around existing codes, can they scale to ASCII size problem? I don't know if you're familiar with ASCII, the big accelerated strategic computing initiative, but you know, the labs are trying to build these huge massively parallel codes and are doing these engineering codes. Can we retrofit a bifurcation analysis application around them, because people, they're not doing that, you know, up front. And so you have to do it with iterative linear solvers, and that the bordering algorithms that we use require inversion of matrices that are being driven singular. And so can you, I'll describe that in a second, but can you have as a center part of your algorithm inverting the matrix that you're driving singular, and how far can you push that algorithm? So what I'm talking about is illustrated here with the turning point algorithm. You have 2n plus 1 equations and 2n plus 1 unknowns. Your residual vector, your Jacobian matrix times some null vector is 0. The null vector has length 1. And you're solving for the solution vector, the null vector, and the parameter. If you just plugged in a full Newton algorithm, and if I was writing a code from scratch, I'd probably do something like this. This will converge nicely. It's non-singular. Great. You can decompose this system to this system, where you do four solves of your Jacobian matrix, your steady-state Jacobian matrix, with these four right-hand sides for A, B, C, and D vectors. You do a little bit of math, and you can recover your delta P, your delta X, and your delta N, your updates. And so in infinite precision arithmetic, this is great, but like I said, you're using four linear solves of your Jacobian matrix to construct one Newton step for your turning point algorithm that's driving the same matrix singular, and you're doing it with iterative solvers. So the question is, how far can you push that, and does that work at all? And then, and to show you for the Hopf algorithm, this is even the same thing but more complex. You have 3n plus 2 equations. This would be your 3n plus 2 by squared system that's non-singular. You can break it into five linear solves, two of your Jacobian matrix, three of your J plus I omega M complex matrix, where omega is actually one of your unknowns of your problem. It's the unknown frequency of the Hopf bifurcation. With all these right-hand sides, do a little, those five solves, a little bit of algebra, and you recover your updates, which are the same as those in infinite precision arithmetic. And these three matrices here, you know, this matrix repeated three times is the one that's getting driven singular in this case. Since we're using iterative linear solvers, we can't reuse our LU decomposition, but we can at least reuse our preconditioner. So for instance, this algorithm where we have four linear solves takes less than four times as long, three and a half times as long, because the preconditioner is maybe, you know, order a quarter of the time of a linear solve. So there's a little bit of savings, but not so much. I don't know how much time I have to get to talk about the eigenvalue capability. This is, from my point of view, very mature for what we're doing, and I haven't been working on this much lately. This is stuff joint with Rich LeHook. But we have three different spectral transformations implemented, shift and invert, and two different versions of the Cayley transformation. This is what Greg Lewis showed this morning. It was analogous to this one. And what I've done is plotted the imaginary versus real part of your spectrum and colored it with the magnitude of the eigenvector once you've done the spectral transformation. So if you have a complex shift and invert, you have eigenvalues in this area, they're going to be huge when your spectral transformation, and they'll converge very fast. Out here, you'll have to do a million Arnoldi iterations to converge those. The Cayley transformation, you can actually blow up a bigger area and get a bigger, have a lot of eigenvalues with big parts. But if you have a big Hopf bifurcation, you'll miss it in favor of a lot of real ones. And then there's Cayley version 2, which works very well, but the magnitudes of these colors are very much smaller than these. So you have to take a lot more Arnoldi iterations, but it's much more robust. You're going to get your Hopf bifurcations no matter how large they are. So that's about all I'm going to talk about the eigenvalue calculation. So that's the algorithms section. Those are the algorithms we implemented. Now the question is how do they work for large for PDE problems? And so the first problem in the biggest stunt calculations we've been doing are the benchmark calculations, whatever you want to call them, are the stability analysis of buoyancy-driven flow. So this problem is 3D Rayleigh-Benard problem in a 5x5x1 box. And so the physics for this problem is you have two parallel plates, and you have a box 5x5 plate 1. You heat the bottom, you cool the top. You solve the Navier-Stokes equations with the Boussinesq approximation, heat transfer, and solve it in 3D and look for flow transitions. We use the MP-SALSA code, which John Shadid is the main author et al., and I'm one of the all here. This is the code project I was hired on at Sandia a while ago. MP-SALSA is an incompressible Navier-Stokes equation with heat and mass transfer and arbitrary number of reactions. It uses an unstructured grid finite element method, though in this case it was structured. All the computations were fully unstructured. The Gert-Lurkin least squares discretization. For constant coefficient problems, it has an analytic and obviously very sparse Jacobian. We use a fully coupled Newton method. We load up the whole Jacobian and solve it with the Aztec package. And the Aztec package uses, what we always select is the GM-RES with the ILUT preconditioner, though it has a whole family of preconditioners. And this is a distributed memory parallel code. And the picture here is showing you a parallel decomposition of a 200,000 node mesh for 320 processors. And you can see the thing is built of bricks and mortar. And the bricks are elements that are completely confined on one processor and don't need any communications to do the finite element fills for those. The red lines between them are the mortar, and those are elements where the nodes, we partition by nodes, and that breaks some elements. And so you have to communicate on the red lines between the bricks. The coloring of blue there and green there and red is totally artificial. That's just the way the package picked the colors. But the red lines between them are, and the bricks in between them are important. So you can tell that there's a relatively small amount of communications compared to the volume, and the communications are local with a dozen or so local processors. So that's and that's using the Chaco code. So now for some physics, what we've done is a bifurcation diagram. We vary the Rayleigh number, which is the buoyancy force, proportional to the temperature gradient or the length cubed. And we've plotted the maximum vertical velocity as the measure of our solution. And this is a very well-known problem that you have no flow up to a critical Rayleigh number, which I think is, the 1706 or something for infinite plates. And you go up, and this one bifurcates to two-dimensional flows. And if we walk up this curve calculating eigenvalues, we find we get a pitchfork bifurcation at that point, when the eigenvalues crosses through zero. So in this mesh that we've used, five coupled PDEs on a 50 by 50 by 20 finite element mesh of linear, trilinear elements, 275,000 unknowns. And so what we've done is in the 2D flow region up to this point, the flow looks like this. These are two-dimensional rolls that release streamlines at different places, but there's five roll cells, cigar-shaped rolls. And this is what the eigenvector looks at the pitchfork, which you can tell it's three-dimensional, but not much else. And so what we've done is we've delineated the no-flow and the 2D flow and the 3D flow regions. So then what we obviously did is launch the pitchfork tracking algorithm as a function of the Prandtl number, the second parameter. So this was the point we calculated before, the one point on the pitchfork curve between the 2D and 3D curves. The no-flow to 2D flow curve is independent of Prandtl number, so we didn't even calculate that. We just drew it across. But we track the pitchfork algorithm, and we go down as a function of Prandtl number, and we can just immediately track out the line between 2D flow and 3D flow in this case. If we calculate eigenvalues along here, there's always one of them that's obviously zero, and by that I mean 10 to the minus 4 or 5 or 6 or so. And then all of a sudden it got overtaken by hop. So here we switch to the hop tracking algorithm, and we can calculate a line of hop that's actually that causes the 2D flow to go 3D. And so at this point here, we've calculated visually located a codimension 2 bifurcation at these points of this 3D flow model. And so if you want to know what the hop bifurcation looks like, if you just can imagine this flow and then add sine times this plus cosine times this in your mind, then you'll see what the instability looks like. So nobody's ever taken my pictures and made a poster and put them in the London Underground, so I don't know why not. And here's kind of a conclusion to this thing. Here's the same plot, but I dropped the Prandtl number to a real instead of a log plot. So these three lines are the same. There's this extra dotted line. This is the mesh resolution. We've gone up to a million unknown calculation and calculated the same pitchfork, and you can see that it's converged kind of, two digits, which is very good, and at least we know that our other one wasn't spurious and that we're very close to converged here. And if you throw solid walls on the end of this box, it actually gets a turning point, and so we've tracked the turning point. So this is a nice model problem to check out all the three algorithms that we've done. And to get you an idea of the calculations, so this 275,000 unknown model run on 128 processors of our ASCII RED machine. A steady solve takes about 5 minutes to solve a steady state. Eigenvalue calculation takes about 10 to 20 minutes to converge 5 eigenvalues. Pitchfork algorithm takes about 25 minutes. This one requires 5, but we use 6 linear solves per iteration. So it's about 6 times that 5 minutes minus time for doing the preconditioner only once. And so walking on the pitchfork takes 25 minutes per point. And the hop algorithm, we actually ran on 200 processors and takes 80 minutes. And that's because it's doubled. You have to solve the bigger complex matrix system. So these are big times, but compared to doing a steady state with an eigenvalue and searching around, it's, and computation time, but especially user time, it's much faster just to track them. And the biggest problems we've done, and this hop, tracking this hop, we had a grad student who went crazy and went to a 16 million unknown problem, so 3.2 million grid points times 5 PDEs. On 2,000 processors, and walked up with zero order or first order continuation. So this should really just say steady, and did the eigensolver on it. Turning in point and pitchfork we've done to about a million, and the hop about 0.7 million. So you can read this in different ways. One, great, we're doing huge problems. The other thing is that we can do steady state calculations up to 16 million, and the turning point and pitchfork up to 1 million. It's hard to define a maximum. You've got so many tolerances. But this number is smaller than this by a little ways. And that's the result of trying to solve singular matrices. These cases, you're not solving singular matrices. These are the ones where your algorithm requires solving these matrices you're driving singular. And so, that's the conclusion. Maybe somehow you got to draw a conclusion. Yes, we got algorithms that scale large. No, you can't push them as far as you can do steady state. It's hard to... wall clock. Oh, wall clock time, 128 processors running together. Linear solves. Yeah. So 99.9% of the time is in the linear solves, doing GM res. And the thing is, when we go up to 100, our algorithms, we talk about scalability, our algorithms, our finite element fills scale perfectly. Newton's iterations stay the same. It's that when our GM res iterations, if you fix the number of processors, which are the fixed number of partitions, which is processors, that just goes up a little bit. the biggest problem we get with scaling is when you do go to more and more processors, your partitions are smaller, your preconditioners based on smaller and smaller parts of the domain don't work as well. So if you had a little bit more, I mean, I think we could do probably fit this on 32 processors, especially if we had 1 gigabyte memory, or we could do it on 16 processors almost as fast. It really, we get a really bad scaling as we go to hundreds and several hundred processors with the domain decomposition preconditioners. Luckily, Ray Tumanaro and Charles Tong and Mark Adams, we have these people that are working on multi-level preconditioners. So when we get plugged in, you know, these numbers should pop way up. So the problem is fun in that it's a big problem, but it's and that we've spent some time, well, a little time anyway, trying to, you know, demonstrate how big we can do and all that. But it's not a very realistic physical problem. It's interesting, but a problem that's of more importance is a real chemical reactor. So this is a chemical vapor deposition reactor. Here's a 3D picture. You have flow coming in. It's a big circular can with a small inset, you know, coaxial can underneath it. Flow comes in the big can, hits the small can, which is rotating, spins in and goes around. The top of this can is heated as a susceptor, and so you have gases come down, dropping off, say, gallium and nitride things and forming a gallium nitride thing. And so this is how you make gallium nitride and gallium. These are blue LEDs and lasers for your CD players and DVD players and stuff are grown in reactors that look like this. So you have a flow, and it's an interesting problem that you have you get instabilities because you have force flow coming down and out. This is just a cross-section. You have rotational flow, and then you have a really hot disk, you know, 1,000 degrees, heating up. And so you have, you know, the buoyancy and the force flow are obviously at odds, and the rotation throws a lot of stuff to the mix. So it's a really interesting problem, and an important problem. And so for this one, I've been doing 2D calculations. We've done a few 3D, but the most interesting things are for the 2D axisymmetric case. And these ones, though I think these calculations were actually done on 8 or 16 processors, because we can do that, and we had a week before the conference proceedings was due, so we just zipped through it as fast as we could. This could all be done on a workstation with a decent amount of memory. So it's, and this is 30,000 unknown mesh. Again, it's three momentum equations, a continuity equation, and a heat equation. And so if you look at this system, and you look at we've decomposed it into two parameters, the Rayleigh number, which is these red arrows, the buoyancy force, and a Reynolds number, which is a rotation rate and the force flow. We've kind of pinned the rotation rate to the flow rate with the von Karman similarity solution. So those are a single Reynolds number describing those two and a buoyancy force. So if we fix the Reynolds number, the flow rate, and change the Rayleigh number, the buoyancy force, or the size, you get some hysteresis. You get some really complicated bifurcation diagrams, and they change. You'll see they change pretty rapidly. But what you get along this branch is a good flow that you want. Flow comes down, looks like a von Karman flow, goes over and goes out, and you get very uniform growth of your, you know, say, gallium nitride film here. Once you go around this hysteresis, you go up to this other stable branch, and you get bad flow. You get a buoyancy-driven force. As your Rayleigh number gets bigger, this gets worse. And as you change Reynolds number, here's a Reynolds number of 92. You go down to 38. This hysteresis is unfolded. You go up to 610. You get this, I don't know, figure eight isola or something, but you still get this turning point. And so instead of going through a arc length and trying to find all these, especially when they're isolas, what we do is just latch onto that turning point and track it. And so what you want to do is tell a designer, design your condition so that your Rayleigh number is below this turning point, which is a function of the Reynolds number, and you'll have good designs. You can only be on this good flow branch instead of the bad flow branch. And so we've done that. We've tracked out that turning point, is the Rayleigh number where the turning point is versus Reynolds number. We've tracked it out. We fit it with a simple curve, and we actually have experimentalists at Sandia who have plugged this into a spreadsheet and are, you know, kind of using it to guide how they run their reactor, which is really exciting. If anybody's worried about the accuracy of our calculations, the guy is going to take this calculation and change this 1.75 to something like 0.5 or 0.75 just to be safe. So. A different order of magnitude. And so this was all in Boussinesq. We actually ran the same thing with ideal gas law. We put nitrogen in there, did full ideal gas, so temperature depending, viscosity, heat capacity, mostly, and density everywhere. And we recalculated this curve. And then there's a choice of how you post-process your Reynolds number and Rayleigh number, because your density and viscosity is a function of temperature. So we found one way that you can post-process your Reynolds and Ridley number so that these curves fall very well on the Boussinesq thing. So we told people if you evaluate your temperatures at the cold inlet temperature, your ideal gas law will fall into this Boussinesq curve very well. And we've hooked up with some optimization people, Larry Beagler at Carnegie Mellon, and this is for the same reactor where we've actually done growth. We do growth and look at the uniformity of growth across spatially and make that the objective function. This is kind of a log of a standard deviation. And if we do a continuation run, we can find that there's a very, very good optimal conditions to grow this, just a one-parameter optimization. It's interesting, when we launched the optimization algorithm from nearby, it converged. We launched it from far away, converged to this point. And it was really interesting to see what it was, is that there was multiplicity in the reactor, which those people weren't expecting. And then this had optimization that converged to a local minimum on the unstable branch, which is really interesting. I showed this at an optimization workshop, and I think it really blew some of them away that they could have multi-valued functions. One guy started talking about global methods finding it, but you know, a global method might land you on that branch, and you wouldn't know to go check the same point again from another angle. So just one cute slide that we hooked up to another code, a free surface flow code. This is a coating where you have flow coming in through a nozzle. So when you're coating post-it notes with the polymer sticky stuff or coating glossy things on paper, they squirt flow out and it hits a web and just gets dragged along. And we've tracked the, and if you pull it too fast, you'll start to get globbing. And so what they do is they put a vacuum, a back pressure, pulling the stuff upstream before it gets entrained. And we've done an operability window. These are two turning points, and in this whole region are things where you get good flow. Too low or too high, you get bad flow. And we've also hooked up to a thermodynamics code. We get phase transition. Here's liquid condensing on some cylinders. You have liquid vapor equilibrium. That's a hysteresis thing. And you get actually my favorite bifurcation diagram from this. This is capillary condensation phase transition. So this is outside my office called the capillary duct, this black curve. And so that's a bifurcation diagram and a phase transition diagram you can do as well. So to summarize, we've been working on a stability analysis tool to scale to large stability calculations. The general purpose algorithms have been put into LOCA. We've tracked bifurcations up to a million unknowns. And then, you know, the punchline, these singular formulations work semi-robustly. It's kind of up to you to decide, or up to the user to decide whether they're good or not. We can do big problems, but not all the way as big, but as you can do a steady state. So future work is to hardware or interface to some common parallel linear solvers, Aztec, Trilinos, and PETSI, and also to LAPACK. And once we hardwire to linear solvers, something we've avoided doing before, if we do that, then we can start doing extra things, like try to implement, you know, A, B, or columns, and just try to implement non-singular formulations that look like that, where we do the work for people using these given supported iterative linear solvers. And so with that, I think we can go to a next generation of better algorithms. And I'd be glad to take suggestions afterwards on exactly which ones to implement or how. And we want to put in multi-parameter continuation methods. Mike Henderson's stuff that he's talked about, we have plans for him to come down and put that in, and then hook up to new application codes, such as buckling. So thank you very much.